morning. Hope everyone is doing well this morning. If you didn't notice, the choir is back, so they'll be here with us for the choir. Yeah. And then before the choir sang, those pictures on the screen, those were our vacation Bible school. Those are our children from the vacation Bible school this summer. So one of the ministries that our ongoing support at Peters Creek, what it provides is things like that for our children. So all of those kids are our kids, and all of that is happening this summer. So that was our vacation Bible school. If you have a Bible with you today, you can open up to Exodus chapter 5. That's where we're going to be studying today, Exodus chapter 5. If you don't have a Bible, we'll put all the scriptures up on the screen for you. But this morning, we are in the middle of a series called Moses, in which we're looking at the life of a man named Moses. And the reason that we're looking at Moses' life is that we are looking specifically at his interactions that he had with God. Because when we look at Moses' interaction with God, people like you and I begin to learn some things. We learn about God and what he is like. We learn about ourselves and what we are like. And we learn about how God deals with people like us. And this morning, the part of Moses' life that we're going to look at might be a familiar one, especially if you've seen the Prince of Egypt or something like that. Today we're going to be looking at the 10 plagues that God sent on the Egyptians. And in the Bible, this part of Moses' life is actually going to span from Exodus chapter 5 all the way to Exodus chapter 12, which means we have a couple of options this morning. One, I'm going to need to summarize a whole bunch of information and trust that you can go back and read those chapters on your own. Or two, we're going to need to extend the sermon to like an hour. Some of you are like, don't we already do that? Because sometimes it feels like that. So I'm going to summarize today. So what I need you to do is go back on your own and read these chapters, chapter 5 to chapter 12, and read those for yourselves. Now, where we left Moses last week, he's an 80-year-old man out in the wilderness. And he's just had an encounter with God where Moses learned that God is going to deliver the Hebrew people from their slavery to the Egyptians, and God is going to use Moses to do it. And last week, we looked at all the excuses that Moses gave to God as to why God should choose somebody else to do this, but God wouldn't let Moses off the hook. Instead, he sends him to Egypt, but he also sends him with his brother Aaron to be his sidekick. And so God's instructions to Moses and to Aaron are they are supposed to go in front of the Pharaoh of Egypt and tell him, God says, let my people go. So Moses and Aaron, they go into Egypt, they stand before Pharaoh, and they tell him just that. And here is the response that the Pharaoh gives them in Exodus chapter 5, verse 2. But Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice? Now, my younger brother and I, when we were little, my mom tells us that I, being the older brother, would sometimes boss my little brother around and tell him what to do. And because of that, my brother developed this saying. He would point his three-year-old finger at me and he would say, you're not the boss of me. Do you have any kids that do that? From an early age, we acknowledge that we don't like to be bossed around. And we don't like to be told what to do, especially from an authority that we don't recognize, like an older brother. And that sentiment doesn't seem to go away as we get older. In fact, it seems that Pharaoh had this same reaction when it came to obeying the voice of the God of Israel. Can you see here Pharaoh shaking his finger at Moses saying, tell your God that he is not the boss of me. Or in his words, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice? Now we should point out that when Pharaoh asks this question, it's not that he doesn't believe that the God of Israel exists. Pharaoh believes in all kinds of gods. The Egyptians worshipped river gods and moon gods and harvest gods. And Pharaoh himself was seen as a son of the gods. So his issue was not, there is no God. Pharaoh's issue was, why should I listen to your God when I have gods of my own? And so Pharaoh wasn't offended that the people of Israel had their own God and had their own religion. What offended Pharaoh was the suggestion that he should have to obey their God. You're not the boss of me. Now, Pharaoh's objection should sound sort of familiar to us, because we live in a world where, like Pharaoh's, people serve many different gods. There are many different religions. There are many different ways of looking at spiritual things. And people in our world tend to think, you can have your way of looking at things, I'll have my way. You can have your religion, I'll have my religion. You can have your understanding of God, I will have mine. And in our world, nobody objects to anybody else's view as long as none of the views tell anybody else what they should believe or do or think. As soon as one view claims this is the way, then all of a sudden everybody turns into Pharaoh and says, "Whoa, you're not the boss of me. Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice?" Isn't that true? Isn't that what happens in the world that we live in? Because in our world, we are very selective with our obedience. Because sometimes for us, obedience seems like a matter of freedom. Because whoever or whatever we obey has power over us. And if someone or something has power over us, then in a sense, they are like our master. And if we have a master, then we are no longer free. And since around here, we love our freedom, we are very stingy with our obedience. Because in our world, we think freedom is not having a master. One definition of freedom says that freedom is the absence of external control, interference, or command. We think that freedom is when we are being controlled by nothing but ourselves, when nobody is interfering in our lives whatsoever, and nobody is telling us what we should or shouldn't do. Isn't that how we think of freedom? But what if we're wrong? What if true freedom is not the absence of a master, but the presence of a right one? Bob Dylan has this song called "Gotta Serve Somebody," and in it, he basically points out that no matter who you are, everybody ends up serving something or someone in some way. Or to put it another way, everybody has a master. To which we think, all right, Bob Dylan, then I will be my own master. Because in our world, it seems that there is no greater freedom than for one to be his own master. But if you think about that, is that really true? Because I don't know about you, but when I look at my own life, some of my biggest mistakes, some of my greatest regrets happened when I was being the master of my own life. And sure, we all make mistakes. We all learn from our mistakes. What doesn't kill us makes us stronger. But if I'm honest with myself, my track record when I am being my own master is not great. I use this illustration all the time, but country singer Garth Brooks wrote this old song called "Unanswered Prayers." And in the song, he sings about going to a high school football game with his wife, and while he's there, he runs into his high school sweetheart. And then he sings, "Thank God for unanswered prayers." I don't know about you, but when I look back at some of the stuff that 17-year-old Dusty was praying to happen in his life, and then 21-year-old Dusty, and then 30-year-old Dusty, I think, whew, thank God for unanswered prayers, right? Because now 36-year-old Dusty looks back and sees all the stuff that I used to want so badly, and I say, what was I thinking? Do you have any what was I thinking moments in your life? Well, the truth is, in those moments, do you know what we were thinking? What we were thinking is, I am the master of my own life, and I think that this is a great idea. Which should prove to us right now that sometimes even we aren't the best masters of our own lives. Now, the reason that I bring all this up is because when we talk about the showdown between Moses and Pharaoh for the freedom of the Hebrews, the freedom that was on the table wasn't just freedom from the Egyptian masters, but it was also freedom to a new master. When Moses stood before Pharaoh, I remembered the "let my people go" part of the story. But did you know that there was more to that command than just "let my people go"? Here is what Moses actually said to Pharaoh. Moses and Aaron went and said to Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness." Now, do you see how God says that the people were supposed to go hold a feast to him? That's an act of worship. So God's command to Pharaoh was not, let my people go so they can do whatever they want. What it was let my people go so they can come and worship me. So God is saying, my people currently serve you, Pharaoh, as their master, but you're going to need to let them go so they can worship me as their God. So according to God, it seems that true freedom is not just the absence of any master, but it's the presence of the right one. And to this, Pharaoh says, you're not the boss of me. Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice? So God answers his question. You want to know who I am? You want to know why you should obey me? Well, here's why. And then God proceeds to send 10 plagues on Egypt. And these plagues were God's answer. Here is who I am, and here is why you should obey me. So let me show you what these 10 plagues were. And since we're summarizing today, I'll use some more visual aids. The first plague that God sent on the Egyptians was that he turned the Nile River into blood. And the river, when it turned to blood, it became unusable, and everything in the river died, but Pharaoh paid no attention to it. So God sent a second plague. And the second plague was that all of Egypt was overwhelmed with frogs. And not just a little bit of frogs, but frogs everywhere, to the point where these frogs completely disrupted their lives. And Pharaoh said, all right, if your God will get rid of all these frogs, then I will let the people go. But as soon as the frogs were gone, Pharaoh changed his mind. So God sent a third plague, which was a swarm of gnats that were said to cover man and beast. And then God sent a fourth plague, which was swarms of flies. And the Pharaoh said, all right. If your God can get rid of these gnats and these flies, then I'll let the people go. But again, as soon as the gnats and the flies were gone, Pharaoh changed his mind. So God sent a fifth plague, which was an epidemic that struck down all the livestock in Egypt. And then he sent a sixth plague, which was another epidemic, but this time it afflicted all the people of Egypt with boils on their skin. But still, Pharaoh did not relent. So God sent a seventh plague, which was hailstorms so great that it took out everything that was out in the open. All the plants, all the animals, all the people, everything. And after this, Pharaoh said, all right, this time I really sinned. Have your God make this storm stop, and I will let the people go. But as soon as the storm stopped, Pharaoh changed his mind. So God sent an eighth plague, which was an infestation of locusts that ate all the plants and all the vegetation and all the land. And of course, Pharaoh pleaded again for it to stop, but again, he changed his mind at the last minute. So God sent a ninth plague, which was 3 days of complete darkness with no light at all. I made this slide by myself. And then after this one, when Pharaoh didn't budge, God warned that there would be a tenth and final plague. And this plague would be that all the lives of the firstborn would die. But Pharaoh held his ground, so God delivered the final plague. And it was said that there was not a house in all of Egypt that did not experience loss. And then finally, Pharaoh let the people go. And according to God, the purpose of all of these plagues was that you may know that there is no one like the Lord our God. And the you that's being talked about here was Pharaoh. And the you that's being talked about here was the Egyptian people. And the you that's being talked about here were the Hebrew people. And the you that's being talked about here is us. According to God, these plagues were supposed to show all of us that there is nobody like the God of Israel. That this God is different from any God that they've ever seen and any master that they've ever served. And I think that these plagues show us three ways that the God of Israel is unlike any other. And the first way is that this God is matchless in power. Now, when it comes to God's power, one of the questions that I always had about the plagues is, why 10, right? If God really wanted to show how powerful he was, couldn't he have gotten this done in one? Because that would have been really powerful, right? Couldn't God have done something right out of the gate that would have been such a demonstration of his power that everybody would immediately have fallen down in fear and obedience right away? Couldn't he have done that? Now, right away, or in fact, after the sixth plague, God actually admits to Pharaoh. He says, by now, I could have stretched out my hand and struck you and your people with a plague that would have wiped you off the face of the earth. So it seems that God is holding back some of his power, doesn't it? Which leads us to believe that these plagues must have been a display of something more specific than just raw power. So what is God trying to show? If you remember last week, before Moses went to Egypt, he was complaining to God that nobody was going to believe him. So God told him to take his staff and to throw it on the ground, and the staff immediately turned into a snake. You remember that from last week? God said, now go do that in front of the people and they will believe you. Now that's a heck of an icebreaker, isn't it? If somebody did that in front of me, I would listen to whatever it is they had to say from a safe distance. But when Moses and Aaron do the very same thing in front of Pharaoh, here's what happens. Aaron threw his staff down in front of Pharaoh and his officials, and it became a snake. Pharaoh then summoned wise men and sorcerers, and the Egyptian magicians also did the same things by their secret arts. Each one threw down his staff, and it became a snake. So you can see why Pharaoh was saying, hey, why should I listen to your God when I have gods of my own that can do this? Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice? But then this happens. Aaron's staff swallowed up their staffs. Now, the use of snakes here is not random. Snakes were a huge part of the Egyptian worship. They believed that the world was created by a god who took the form of a snake. So when Aaron's snake ate all the other snakes, God was declaring, there is none like me. And in the same way, each plague that God sent specifically challenged an element of the Egyptian world. For example, to the Egyptians, the Nile River was everything. The river was associated with the god of fertility that they worshipped. And when God turned the Nile River into blood, rather than fertility, everything in the river died. So by doing this, God was declaring, is this what you guys worship? There's none like me. Another one of the Egyptian gods had the head of a frog. And so God plagued them with so many frogs that it ruined their lives. Is this what you guys worship? There is none like me. Another Egyptian goddess had the head of a cow, and another the head of a bull. And when God sent the plague that killed all the bulls and all the cows, he was saying, is this what you worship? There is none like me. And more than this, the Egyptian goddess of the sky, she could do nothing to stop the plague of the hail. And then the greatest Egyptian god, Ra, the god of the sun, he was powerless when God plagued the Egyptians with darkness. So can you see how through these plagues, God was declaring, there is none like me. I am matchless in my power. Can you see that? Because even though Pharaoh was stubborn, the people around him were starting to see it. Even at one point, even the magicians said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. Even his own magicians and sorcerers were starting to see, hey, Pharaoh, the God of Israel is better. There is none like him. And through these plagues, they were even beginning to recognize that God had matchless power. That's the first thing that these plagues teach us about God. But these plagues also teach us something more about God. They also teach us that God is the creator and the sustainer. Now, when you step back and look at these plagues as a whole, there is a natural element to them. Like when the Nile River becomes uninhabitable, what would naturally happen next? Well, all the frogs would leave the river, and they would go someplace else, like into the homes of the Egyptians. And what would naturally happen when all these frogs started to die? Well, it would breed gnats and flies. And what would naturally happen with this many gnats and flies? Well, they would spread disease, hence the epidemic that killed all the livestock. And what would naturally happen with that much dead livestock lying around? Well, the people would probably get sick, hence the boils. So you see, there's an element to these plagues that seems natural. And scholars point out that what is happening here is that these plagues are showing an undoing of what happened at creation. When God created the world, he made something out of nothing. He made order out of chaos. And here in the plagues, we see the opposite. We see nature unraveling. We see chaos where there used to be order. We see everything falling apart. And it's as if God is saying, oh, you want to know why you should obey me? You want to know who I am? Well, I am the God who designed and created all of this. And not only that, I am the God who sustains it and holds it all together. So Pharaoh, if you think you're the one in charge, if you think you want to be your own master, well, let me just take my hands off of everything for a minute and let's see what happens. And without God holding everything together, without God in the center, everything falls apart. Which is exactly why the God of Israel is different than all the other gods. Because not only does God have power in this world, he is the one who designed it and created it and holds it all together. And without him, nothing works. Everything falls apart. But when God is in the center, When his voice is listened to, when his ways are obeyed, the outcome is different. Now, I've always wondered what it must have been like to be an Egyptian who was neighbors with one of the Hebrews during all of this. Because the Egyptian experience of the plagues was very different than the Hebrew experience. Before the fourth plague, God explained this to Pharaoh. God said to Pharaoh, "I will deal differently with the land of Goshen where my people live. No swarms of flies will be there, so that you will know that I, the Lord, am in this land. I will make a distinction between my people and your people, Pharaoh." So you see how the Hebrew experience was very different than the Egyptian one? I imagine that the Israelites are in their backyard having a barbecue while their Egyptian neighbors next door are picking flies out of all their food, looking over the fence saying, "Lucky." And this wasn't the only time, because after the fifth plague, it says all the livestock of the Egyptians died, but not one animal belonging to the Israelites died. And then in the ninth plague, Moses stretched out his hand toward the sky, and total darkness covered all Egypt for 3 days. No one could see anyone else or move about for 3 days, yet all the Israelites had light in the places where they lived. Do you see how God made a distinction between his people and the people of Egypt? The people of Israel, the ones who worshiped God, the ones who obeyed his voice, the ones whose lives were built around the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they were spared from many of the hardships and trauma that came upon Egypt. But the Egyptians, the people who had built their lives on other things and other gods, it seemed like their whole world was falling apart. And even though everything was falling apart around him, Pharaoh maintained, "You're not the boss of me. I'm the master of my own life. Who is the Lord that I should obey him?" But not everybody in Egypt was sharing in Pharaoh's stubbornness. Before the seventh plague, God gave this warning to everybody. God said, "At this time tomorrow, I will send the worst hailstorm that has ever fallen on Egypt. Bring your livestock and everything you have in the field to a place of shelter, because every person and animal that has not been brought in will die." And then check this out. So those officials of Pharaoh, the Egyptians, who feared the word of the Lord, hurried to bring their slaves back and their livestock inside. Do you see how some of the Egyptians were starting to see what these plagues were teaching? That there is none like this God. And some of the Egyptians even started raising their hands. "Hey, I will, over here, I will obey the voice of the Lord." Some of us around here in Egypt, we're starting to figure it out. It seems that when we don't obey the voice of the Lord, stuff falls apart. So I will obey. Do you see the lesson that these plagues are teaching? When you don't put God in the center of your life, when you don't obey his voice, stuff falls apart. Because he is the creator and the sustainer. Now let's take a time out here and talk about ourselves for a second. Because in this story, Pharaoh is the obvious bad guy. And if you're like me, whenever I read the Bible, I always read myself into the good guy parts and not the bad guy parts. So I don't think of myself as Pharaoh. But if I'm honest, sometimes in my life, I sound like him. Especially when it comes to matters of obedience. Now, there are certain parts of the Bible that talk about things that we should and shouldn't do. There are parts of the Bible that talk about how we should handle our relationships, how we should handle our money, how we should handle our marriages, how we should handle our public lives, how we should handle our private lives. And because all of these parts of the Bible seem to suggest that we should obey them, that little three-year-old inside of me and inside of Pharaoh comes out and starts saying, "You're not the boss of me. Don't tell me how to live my life. Don't tell me how to handle my business. I'll be my own master when it comes to that issue. Thank you very much." Because remember, we love our freedom. And sometimes obedience feels like a loss of freedom. Because we think that real freedom is being able to do whatever we want, whenever we want to, without any restriction, without any interference, without any rules, and without anybody telling us what we should or shouldn't do. But remember, according to God, true freedom is not the absence of a master, but the presence of a right one. Now let's say that your body feels like it's falling apart physically. and you're constantly sick, and your stomach hurts all the time, and you go to the doctor to get some answers, and he runs a bunch of tests, and he says, I found the problem. It's gluten. And then he tells you that you're going to need to follow this super strict diet, and all the food that you used to eat, you can't eat it anymore. All the restaurants that you want to go to, you can't go to them anymore. From now on, you're going to have to give up a whole bunch of stuff that you like. And after hearing that kind of news, do you know what we would never say to that doctor? We would never say, you're not the boss of me. Don't tell me how to live my life. Don't tell me what I can and can't eat. Bring on the gluten. Of course, we would never say that, because we automatically recognize that the doctor knows some things about how the body works better than we do. And we automatically recognize that his recommendations, however restrictive they may seem, we know that they are for our own good. Isn't that true? Then why is it we can't apply that same thinking to God? God doesn't just know stuff. He created it, all of it. Don't you think he knows how it works a little bit better than we do? So maybe all of those parts of the Bible that he wants us to obey, maybe those parts, the ones that we look at and we call rules, and we call them restrictions, and we call them loss of freedom, maybe they're actually part of a design intended for our good. Because I think we all have some examples from our own lives, I sure do, where we've taken God out of the center of our lives, and we did things the way that we wanted to do it, without the restrictions, without the rules, without the interference. And what happened? Everything fell apart, didn't it? Isn't that true? Don't you have some stories like that in your life? So maybe the plagues can teach us that the God of Israel is the creator and the sustainer, who designed us in such a way that when we put him in the center of our lives, and when we obey his voice, and when we follow his ways, it is actually for our good. So, there's a question that's on the table for us then. Are there any matters of obedience in your life right now, where, like Pharaoh, you're shaking your finger at God saying, you're not the boss of me, not on this one. Don't tell me what I can and can't do. Don't tell me how I should live my life. Don't meddle with this, God. I'm the master of this. You have any issues like that, matters of obedience that you're going through right now? Just saying. Now, the last thing I want us to see in the plagues is this. One of the ways that God is like no other judge is that he is a saving judge. Now, when we think about judgment, we automatically think of it in a negative connotation. We automatically think punishment when we talk about judgment, right? And for some people, that is the view of God that they have adopted. God is this judgmental God who's always looking over our shoulders, trying to catch us doing something so he can punish us. And people who view God like that will view these plagues like that. See, there he goes again, spitting out judgment, throwing plagues on people. Of course he is. But when we look closely at the plagues, with the judgment, there is also people being saved. Now, obviously, the people of Israel are being saved. It's kind of how this whole thing started. To free the Israelites from their Egyptian slavery. But it appears that there might have been more people being saved than just the Hebrews. Remember at the seventh plague, even some of the Egyptians started to obey the voice of the Lord and bring their livestock inside just like he said, so they wouldn't get killed with the hail. Now I wonder, how far did those Egyptians take their obedience? Because after all the plagues are over, after Pharaoh finally lets the Israelites leave, here is how their departure is described. In chapter 12, it says, and the people of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, besides the women and children. A mixed multitude also went up with them. Now, who are these people? They're not Israelites, right? What if there were some Egyptians who came to fear and follow and obey the God of Israel because of the plagues? Can you imagine what their testimony would be? They would say, the very plagues that were meant to be my judgment ended up being my salvation. Now, there is no other God who does that, who brings salvation out of judgment. But this God sent Moses to tell his people, I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great acts of judgment. And the salvation that God brought out of the judgment of the plagues was just a foreshadow of the salvation that God was going to bring in the future. Because of our sin, we are all guilty and we all deserve judgment. Every single one of us. But God loved us so much that all of the plagues of judgment that we deserved were poured out on Jesus on the cross. And through his death, our judgment was satisfied and we were saved. Colossians says, "For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in Jesus and through him to reconcile to himself all things by making peace through his blood shed on the cross." The same God who through the plagues delivered the Israelites out of their slavery to the Egyptians has also delivered us from our slavery to sin through Jesus. Who is the Lord that we should obey him? This is who the Lord is. Did you see that this morning? Will you stand with me as I pray for us? God, we thank you that you are a God who is powerful, more powerful than anything that we can imagine. And God, we thank you that you use your power for our good. God, we thank you that because we see your goodness in Jesus, because we see that you love us so much, that you did what we could not do on our own, that you sent Jesus to take on the punishment that we deserve so that we could have salvation, we learn that you love us. And you care for us, and you are for our good. And because we know that you are for our good, when we see your power, when we witness it, we know that you are a God who has created and designed everything. And so, because of your goodness in Jesus, we trust you, knowing that when you tell us to do things, when you ask us to obey you, when you tell us what we should and shouldn't do, when we can trust that you have a design, and it's for our good. God, I pray that this week, you would gently show us areas of obedience where we have taken you out of the center of our life, where we're waving our finger at you and saying, "You're not the boss of me on this one." And God, I pray that we would come to trust that you are the God who has designed us in such a way that when you command us and tell us to do things, it's for our good. And God, we are reminded that your goodness is completely embodied in Jesus. That of course you are for us because you loved us so much that you sent us Jesus to save us. We thank you and we pray all of this in Jesus' name. Amen.